participating in social change. And, you know, friends, this is like we've been hearing about with the international analyses provided by Oliver Stone and Helen Caldicott this morning. We know that we are living in some pretty tough times, some pretty dire times politically. So by all means, this is very, very important that we come together and we unite and we keep the people's airwaves in the hands of the people so that we can continue this defiant broadcasting. 877-500-5266.
And we're being held by small hands today, the small hands of Guevara, who at the age of 4 has made her first contribution to community radio. Thank you, Guevara.
There we go.
You can join Guevara at 877-500-5266. It's great to get a contribution from Guevara, who's
so
often
cool.
Seen hereabouts. 877-500-KABU. This is the time. You are the person. Make the phone ring. It makes us smile. We'll be so happy to take your pledge. It's just 3 minutes of your time. 877-500-KBOO. And now back to programming.
All right. Thank you very much, Ani and Teresa. It is KBOO Portland, and we're getting ready to kick off Between the Covers with your host, David Naiman. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or Facebook.com/Grendel's Coffeehouse. Also, thanks to Stephouse Networks, offering high-speed residential and business internet services throughout the Portland area. More information about Stephouse Internet Services is available at 503-548-2000 or at stephouse.net. We've got a special gift for this coming half hour here as part of Between the Covers. We've got for a $75 minimum pledge, we have a 2-CD set of 2 separate interviews with author Ursula K. Le Guin. And we will be doing that for a $75 minimum pledge here during the next half hour. So get your 2-CD set of Ursula K. Le Guin. Perhaps you can call it Le Guinterview. Your 2-CD set could be yours for $75, so give us a call. And once again, that number is 877-500-5266. Here's Between the Covers.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. It would be hard to overstate the accomplishments of today's guest, nor their influence upon and importance to the world of literature at large. Ursula K. Le Guin is the author of more than 60 books of fiction, fantasy, children's literature, poetry, drama, criticism, and translation. Her awards include a National Book Award, a Penn Malamud, 6 Nebulas, 5 Hugos, and 21 Locus Awards, from her 1973 Lathe of Heaven to her 2010 Cheek by Jowl, the most by any writer to date. In 2000, the Library of Congress named Le Guin a living legend for her significant contributions to America's cultural heritage. And in 2014, Le Guin was awarded the Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters by the National Book Foundation, whose past winners include Toni Morrison, John Ashbery, and Joan Didion. Le Guin is also active and figures prominently in the community of writers in the world. She's one of the founding members of Literary Arts here in Portland, and writers from Neil Gaiman, Zadie Smith, David Mitchell, and Salman Rushdie have cited Le Guin as a major influence on their work. Ursula K. Le Guin has also made the news quite a bit lately. In 2008, Occupy Oakland activists fashioned shields to appear like the cover of her anarchist utopian classic, The Dispossessed. In 2009, Le Guin publicly resigned from the Authors Guild to protest the settlement with Google, getting hundreds of authors to join her in petitioning a federal judge to exempt the U.S. from the settlement that would allow Google to digitize books with disregard to copyright. And most recently in 2014, in what has been characterized as the most ferocious speech in National Book Foundation history, Ursula Le Guin used the acceptance speech as an opportunity to lambast the deepening corporatization and commodification of books and their authors by the likes of Amazon. Le Guin's thoughtful, principled, and progressive insights are also evident in her approach to teaching the craft of writing, and it is this topic she is here to talk about today. Her 1998 classic, Steering the Craft, has been revised and rewritten. And this new edition, Steering the Craft, a 21st Century Guide to Sailing the Sea of Story, has been hailed as a book that deserves to have a place on every writer's shelf and was called by Library Journal in their starred review a must-read for intermediate and advanced writers of fiction and memoir. Welcome to Between the Covers, Ursula K. Le Guin.
Thank you, David.
So, Ursula, the original edition was a classic in the field of the craft of writing. But after 10 years of being out in the world, you realized that it needed to be revised, or you wanted to revise it, that enough had changed in the publishing world and in the world of writers that it needed a new life. Tell us about what had changed and what's different about the new edition of Steering the Craft.
It's the same book, but every single sentence was rewritten. And part of it was just that I was 10, 12 years older, and looked back on some of the things I said and thought, that's not quite right. I can say that better. Also, I got feedback from people who used the book, like about the exercises and so on, and that was really good. So I could use, you know, reader feedback. And then there was this whole essentially sort of revolution that has overturned publishing as it existed, even in the late 90s when the book was written. And we're all sort of really out at sea now on that one, not knowing quite what's going to happen next. And so some of the old advice that one always gave to young writers is just no good anymore. Steering one's craft these days, really, it's nobody quite knows where they're going, including the publishers.
Well, you say at the beginning of Steering the Craft, it's a handbook for storytellers. Mm-hmm. And yet it's not so much geared towards the beginning storyteller. It's for people who are already engaged in working on their craft with some dedication. What distinguishes it as a craft book for people who are maybe a little farther along in writing than someone who's just starting?
Well, for one thing, it simply doesn't do all the you can write sort of encouragement thing. It grew out of a workshop at Flight of the Mind. And the people in that workshop were all committed writers already. Many hadn't published. That's not the point. It's the commitment that counts. And so I just sort of assume that commitment in the book, and that you're really interested not so much in being a success as a writer or something, or just being a writer, as in writing well, telling your story the best you can. It's lovely how people respond to that. And that is what they want.
You don't shy away from using imitation as a way to learn to write. And that's something very common in other fields. Painters, obviously, probably dancers and other art
musicians,
forms are always imitating in order to find their voice and to hone their craft. But it's something that writers traditionally have seemed a little shy or a little worried about.
Maybe not traditionally, but sort of 20th century. The thing is, with writing, it gets confused with plagiarism. Imitation in the arts has to be seen by the person doing it as a learning device. And particularly the internet has confused an awful lot of people. And competition in college for writing papers, plagiarism is sort of blurred into imitation. And of course they're totally different things, so they have different purpose. You imitate only to learn and you don't publish it. Or if you do, you say this is an imitation of Hemingway or something, you know. But it got all blurred, and so a lot of teachers began to really scold people for imitating in fiction or in writing. And that's you know, that's kind of foolish. Cuz you have to learn by reading good stuff and trying to write that way. There, you know, a piano player who never heard any other piano players, how would he know what to do? We're not using imitation as it could be used, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point. The sound of language, you say, is where it all begins, and that language at its core is a physical thing. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of sound for you and in relationship to storytelling?
I hear what I write. I started writing poetry when I started writing real young, you know,
when I learned to write, I started writing. And I've always heard it in my head. And I realized that a lot of people who write about writing really don't seem to hear it. They don't listen to it. And there's a kind of theoreticalness about what they talk about, the length of sentences and stuff. It's all more sort of intellectual. But if it's happening in your body, if you're hearing what you write, you're going to hear the right cadence of the sentence, which will help the sentence run clear. And what young writers always talk about, finding their voice. Well, you can't find your own voice unless you're listening for it. And the sound of your writing is maybe leading you into something that you... I think most of our writing, our teaching of writing, kind of ignores it. Hmm. Except maybe when people read poetry and then they listen to the sound of it. But prose, they forget that, you know, there's prose that goes clunk, clunk, clunk. There's an awful lot of it.
You have this wonderful quote from your talk at Literary Arts and Lectures in 2000. I'm just going to read it back. Beneath memory and experience, beneath imagination and invention, beneath words, there are rhythms to which memory and imagination and words all move. The writer's job is to go down deep enough to feel that rhythm and let it move memory and imagination to find the words. And I think you were saying this in relationship to Virginia Woolf.
That is essentially something that I learned consciously from Virginia Woolf, who talks about it in similar terms. Her phrase, the wave in the mind.
And you cite Virginia as a perhaps the best example of the use of rhythm, I believe, in Steering the Craft.
She's just an amazing example of the use of a long and subtle rhythm in prose. Hmm. But there are many, many others. I did an essay about essentially the rhythm of Tolkien's writing in The Lord of the Rings. There are short rhythms and long rhythms, and there's a cyclical repetition in his work, which I think is part of why it totally enchants so many of us. We're caught in the rhythm and we're happy there.
Another thing that I think makes Steering the Craft a standout book is both your emphasis of knowing grammar terminology, and also your interrogation of it at the same time. So you stress the importance of knowing grammar, terminology, and not dismissing punctuation, because these are the tools of our craft as writers. Yet many writers, I think, are shy away from these tools. Talk a little bit about punctuation and grammar.
My generation, and for a while after, I was born in 1929, we were taught in public school grammar right from the start. And everybody kind of went, subject, predicate, blah, 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 you know. But all the same, it was quietly drilled into us, and we knew the names of the parts of speech, and we had a kind of working acquaintance with English, which they don't get in school anymore, in most schools. There's so much less reading in schools, and there's very little teaching of grammar. And for a writer, this is kind of like being thrown into a carpenter's shop without ever having learned the names of the tools or handled them consciously. You know, what do you do with a Phillips screwdriver? What is a Phillips screwdriver? So it's we're not equipping people to write. We're sort of saying, you too can write. Anybody can write. You can write. Just sit down and do it, you know. But you got to have the toolbox.
You talk in the book about the usefulness of diagramming sentences, that in diagramming sentences, sometimes you discover that the sentences have skeletons.
Now, I was not taught that in school. That was the previous generation. My mother and my great aunt could diagram a sentence, and they showed me how. And having that kind of mind, I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But, and it is, for anybody who has that kind of mind, it's illuminating just to see. It is kind of like drawing the skeleton of a horse. Oh, that's how they hang together, you know.
Well, it's also interesting to think of sentences having skeletons and thus, in a sense, being different animals, which would then go back to the idea of rhythm and sound because they would all walk differently.
They each has a different gait. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Ursula K. Le Guin about her revised and rewritten craft book, Steering the Craft, A 21st Century Guide to Sailing the Sea of Story. Well, every so often in Steering the Craft, you have an opinion piece. And one of my favorites is about morality and grammar. And you talk about how morality and language are linked, but how morality and correctness are not the same thing. And we often confuse morality and correctness in the realm of grammar. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. That's where what somebody else gave me this phrase for the grammar bullies. They tend to write in, you read them in places like the New York Times and so on, and they tell you what is correct and what, and you know, you must never use hopefully, like hopefully we'll be going there on Tuesday. That's incorrect and wrong, and you are basically a sort of an ignorant pig if you say it. Well, this is this judgmentalism. And what the game that's being played there is a game of social class. I'm sorry. It has nothing to do with the morality of writing and speaking and thinking clearly, which, well, Orwell, for instance, talked about so well. It's just affirming, I'm from a higher class than you are. And the trouble is that people who aren't taught grammar and such very well in school fall for these statements from these pundits, delivered with vast authority from above, you know. And so I'm kind of fighting that. It's a very interesting case in point is using they for singular and how this is wrong, and offends the grammar bullies enormously. Well, it was a rule that was invented basically in the 18th century. It didn't exist in English before. Shakespeare used they instead of he or she. We all have always done it in speaking, in colloquial English. And it took the women's movement to sort of bring it back into written English. But it's important. See, there's a kind of crossroads between the correctness bullying and the moral use of language. If he includes she, but she doesn't include he, big statement's being made.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we got they. Why not use it?
Well, this difference between grammatical correctness and the way language engages moral questions is interesting. It reminds me of this quote that you've said, we can't restructure society without restructuring the English language. So essentially, the battle is at the sentence level as much as it is in the world.
Oh, yeah. And that, again, I read George Orwell's great essay. I can't remember what it's called, the one about writing English clearly being a political matter. I read that as a freshman in college, and it went real deep into me. So often I'm simply rephrasing Orwell.
Well, and it's reflected in your work as well. Like I think of The Dispossessed, which is the novel about an anarchist utopia, and there's no property, but there's also no possessive pronouns. So there's a way in which the world and the language of the world are reflecting back in a sort of unison.
They, in the novel, the founders of this anarchist society made up a new language because they realized that using the old one was, you couldn't have this society and that language. So they obviously they based the new language on the old one, but they changed it enormously, which is simply a kind of an illustration of what Orwell was saying, I think.
So lots of these rules that are really rules of correctness, which sort of reflect back maybe some regressive tendencies in society, you call fake rules. And so, on the one hand, steering the craft really talks about the importance of really engaging with our tools, like using punctuation, understanding its power, and understanding grammar, but also not falling for these fake rules. And you mentioned one around the generic pronoun he for both men and women.
Yeah.
And in the way that is an example of erasing women at the sentence level. And I also remember reading that you, if you could rewrite Left Hand of Darkness, your book that is way ahead of its time and about gender fluidity, you would make some different changes on the sentence level. Is that true? Would you make some changes around the use of pronouns? And
obviously, it's unsatisfactory to call these genderless people he all the way through the book, as I do, unless one of them goes into camera and has gender, and then it becomes genuinely he or she. You cannot use they that way. That would be totally confusing. And made up pronouns drive me mad. When the book, soon after the book was written, particularly in the 80s, there were several books written with made up pronouns. And I just can't do that to English. But what do you do? I've tried this and that. I rewrote a short story and a chapter of Left Hand of Darkness, simply making everybody she instead of he. And it's very interesting to read it after having read the he version, you know. But it's not right either, because they aren't she. They're they. You know, but we can't do it. So I just envy the Finnish, and I think the Japanese, at least in some respects, can speak genderlessly. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just envious.
Yeah. Well, to look at this micro and macro issue, if we're looking at changing language and changing society, you've also raised concerns about the ways in which women writers get disappeared from the conversation, particularly when it comes to entering or not entering the canon. And I think in one conversation, someone asked you for examples, and you'd mentioned Grace Paley, if I remember, as a possible person who may be sliding out of the conversation.
I fear for Grace's reputation, because it is so... It happens so often that a writer who's very much admired but never was not really, really a bestseller famous, you know, that however admired by many, many critics and all that, but she just slides out of sight so fast and the place is filled by a man. Well, no man could possibly fill Grace Paley's place because she wrote extraordinarily much as a woman. And that may be part of the problem. I don't know.
It was interesting. When I had Joe Walton on the show, we engaged this conversation. Mm-hmm. And she was saying, you know, it's difficult in any given moment to know whether, often it's difficult in any given moment to know when sexism's happening. But if you step back and look at the way the canon is formed, say, in science fiction and fantasy, she said, let's look at William Gibson when he wrote Neuromancer, won the Hugo and many other awards. And around the same time, C.J. Cherry also won the Hugo, I think the year before, seemed to be informing the conversation, won a Hugo again 6 or 7 years later, seemed just as successful. And now you look back and Gibson's in the canon and a lot of people are, who is C.J. Cherry?
That's true. I hadn't really thought about it. Why has she been reprinted? Why isn't she talked about? There is something slightly mysterious about this. I mean, it's not always just simple sort of male prejudice. There is something else at work about how men work together without women. And I don't know. I can't take that any further.
Yeah. In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Ursula K. Le Guin about her revised and rewritten craft book for writers, Steering the Craft, a 21st Century Guide to Sailing the Sea of Story. Well, you've been an outspoken critic, Ursula, of the continued commodification of books and the commodification of the authors of the books and how sales departments are taking over from editorial. So a lot of the choices in how a book ends up being shaped and changed are less about art and more about commerce. In a way, I feel like Steering the Craft plays a subtle role that pushes back against that, in the sense that it really expands the way literature can be viewed, not just in terms of what's in vogue. So you're not against the choices that are in vogue necessarily, but you try to expand the conversation when there's a popular choice such as present tense or very short sentences. You both look at the limitations of those choices, but give plenty of examples of long histories of other choices. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, it's there are advantages and disadvantages to living a very long time, as I have. But one of them is you can't help getting a long view. You've just seen it. You've seen it come and seen it go. And you can recognize a sort of trendy thing that is being announced as the absolute way you must write. And, you know, it's fairly visibly, well, that's the way to write right now if you want to sell right now to a right now editor. But there is also the long run. And yeah. I guess my book kind of stands for the long run in writing rather than the short term instant salability.
You've been listening to Between the Covers, and we've been talking today with Ursula K. Le Guin, the author of Steering the Craft. Thanks for tuning in.
And you are listening to Ursula K. Le Guin speaking with David Naiman here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Ani.
I'm Teresa.
And we are asking for your support this morning to be one of our grassroots funders here at 877-500-5266. Ursula Le Guin has been like a hero of mine since 1977 when I first read The Lathe of Heaven. And she is such a visionary writer. She is reimagining how the world could be. She, her work around gender and what we could truly be like in a differently gendered or genderless differently gendered society, and looking at how social constraints that we assume in the society shape us. She's amazing. And you are listening to her right now on KBOO, interviewed by our volunteer, David Naiman. And I can let you know that you can get a 2-CD set of 2 interviews with Ursula K. Le Guin talking with David Naiman right now when you dial 877-500-5266. Your $75 contribution will get you this 2-interview disc set. These are fascinating conversations to share around with your friends, to listen to over and again, talking about how language shapes society. And in order to create a society with new ideas and new rules, we have to look at how we use language and the interplay there. It's a fascinating conversation. Be a part of it. 877-500-5266.
And a thank you to Lindsay in Southeast Portland, who gave online at kboo.fm. Thank you so much, Lindsay. Appreciate that. To light a candle is to cast a shadow. That's a quote of Ursula Le Guin. Yeah. I enjoy listening to her voice. It's such a pleasure. If you're like me and you find that a pleasure, then why not get a 2-CD set, 2 hours of Ursula Le Guin talking, 2 hours of recordings of Between the Covers host David Naiman interviewing Ursula Le Guin. Ursula, let's see if I can pronounce it correctly, Kroeber Le Guin. The first interview was conducted in 2015, and she talks about the revised edition of her book, Steering the Craft. Second interview is from 2016 at the time of the release of Late in the Day, Le Guin's collection of poems. The focus is the search for meaning in an ever-connected world. You can get that by calling us at 877-500-5266, 877-500-5266, and pledging $75 as a minimum. And that's just a few dollars per month. We can set it up to take it out of your bank account if you like. We can certainly take it from your credit card. You can walk in and give us a jar of pennies any way you want to do it. 877-500-5266, 877-500-KBOO, 877-500-5266. You need to do it right now and get yourself those CDs. One last time, 877-500-5266. And
you can get those CDs, I gotta say, just I $75. It breaks down to $6.25 a month, my friends. Please call in right now with your commitment to your community radio station for $6.25 a month. Avail yourself of these two CDs. Help us raise the $400 goal we have for the rest of this hour, and help us finish this membership drive successfully by Saturday at 2. Call right now, 877-500-5266.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Hemp Stock 2016, September 24th and 25th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park in Portland. The 11th Annual Hemp Stock Harvest Festival advocates decriminalization of cannabis for medicinal, industrial, and recreational use, and features food vendors, live music, guest speakers, and information booths. Entertainers include Mac and Dub, Unusual Suspects, Weed Al Dankovic, and more. Again, that's Hempstock 2016, September 24th and 25th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, Portland's neighborhood theater since 1924, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, and salads, located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, laurelhursttheater.com.
Hello, and welcome to a special membership drive edition of the film show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Today we have some fascinating guests in the studio. Dawn Smallman is here to talk about the Portland Eco Film Festival, and she's brought along some celebrated filmmakers, Taggart Siegel and John Betts. They're the documentarians behind The Real Dirt on Farmer John and Queen of the Sun. Their new film, Seed, The Untold Story, will be part of the festival.
And I'll be finding out the story behind Pillars of Portland, a misbegotten 80s soap opera, which will be part of a revival screening at the Northwest Film Center. Director Tom Chamberlain will talk about his adventures working with such young